Welcome to the Serious Serengeti. We're your hosts, David Swinniger and Matthew Keener. Stop what you're doing and subscribe to our podcast and leave us an awesome five-star review. And follow us at Serengeti Sec on Twitter.
You can't see me, but I'm doing hand motions over here to go with that. We're here to talk about some recent news headlines and hopefully provide some insight, analysis, and practical application you can take in the office and help you protect your organization.
And as usual, the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are ours and ours alone and do not reflect the views or opinions of our employers.
Today, we're discussing red flags, but not the ones my ex said she should have seen years ago. All right, episode number one. What are some red flags in a vendor security assessment? Pulled this article off of Dark Reading. It's a pretty short one. It's an okay article. It's only about four paragraphs long, but it has one really interesting thing in here. This person, John Bambinick, principal threat hunter at Net and Rich, mentions that he likes including security requirements that a vendor either cannot do or frankly would be kind of dumb for them to do. And he uses this to try to validate if the person filling out the vendor security assessment is actually reading each of them or is just, you know, checking the box on each one. This reminds me of I thought it was apocryphal, but David and I discussed it before we started recording. And it turns out it's real. The old story about Van Halen and the brown M&Ms, they required no brown M&Ms in their contract rider. And apparently the point of that was to validate if the promoter they were working with actually read the rider, because if they didn't read the rider, the Van Halen road show had a ton of very heavy equipment and they couldn't play on all stages because they needed it to be a certain load bearing and they needed it to be prepped in certain ways, et cetera, et cetera. And if they didn't read the rider about the brown M&Ms, they found that they probably also did not read the parts about what kind of stage prep was required.
Basically, the important parts.
Yeah. So any thoughts on adding a kind of an honesty check for the requirements questionnaire?
I think it's a good idea, but I think it can be challenging though to figure out exactly something that's not too over the top.
So, I mean, well, but the thing is, you do have to balance it. You're right. Like you're saying, you can't make it too over the top because otherwise they're like full rectal exams to validate the identity of every person that walks in the office is too much.
Right. Or maybe something more along the lines of, you know, requires biometric authentication to critical systems or something like that, which is going to be, you know, virtually unheard of. I think that's what's, you know, it's got to be somewhere in the middle, something that the vendor's obviously going to say, well, this is some kind of joke or something, right? Or something that, you know, they could possibly be doing and it can reasonably say, yeah, we do that. What you might be able to do as well is put in one of those questions that is kind of middle of the road, maybe that's they're unlikely to do, but it's possible that they are. And then ensure you have a follow-up conversation with them to ask them about the details of their implementation or something. So you can clearly see where they're lying to you, because if they say, oh yeah, we do this thing, and then they can't explain how they've done it, then that would give you the indicator that they're lying.
Micro-segmentation, every system in its own VLAN.
It's a different opinion about what's over the top and what's not, something like that. At least from my opinion, would be over the top. But everybody's got to find their own thing about what they think makes sense, and it could be really dependent. Well, not could be, but it will depend on who you're talking to. If you're talking to, you know, a small contractor who's got 100 people, you know, you can probably bring that bar down a bit and still be over the top for them. But if you're talking to Cisco or somebody, which, you know, hopefully you don't have to have those kinds of concerns with a large vendor like that, but somebody who's much bigger will clearly do some of these more extravagant, if you will, security measures.
Yep. So, and his last line here really resonates with me. In the end, if a vendor lies to you during the sale, they'll lie to you after the sale. I have some personal experience with this. Definitely had a vendor a couple of years ago lie like a dog about a product we purchased, and I have not gotten over it.
Scarred for life.
Can't believe you did it to me. All right. I just, like I said, that was a pretty simple article. It had one kind of really interesting thing in it, and we talked about it.
Well, I'm wondering if there's something you can do about that when they do lie. you know, maybe in some kind of damaging their reputation sense or something outside of Yelp that's more focused on security vendors or something. I don't know.
I've never heard of a venue that's directly focused. I mean, obviously there's Twitter, but you know, if you have only 40 people follow me, then it's not getting much traction. Reddit, maybe there's a couple security operations or security focused subreddits.
Yeah, whatever it is, you want to have some kind of impact on their behavior, or at least for the vendor to recognize that that salesman was out of line or whatever. That's why it's also helpful to when you're talking with a new vendor to say, okay, I want to talk to one of your other customers. And I'm trying to think about if we did this before, but you talk to the vendor and you say, I want to talk to one of your customers. And then when you're talking to that customer, you ask them about someone else. So you get someone who's second removed from the vendor, because they're obviously going to tell you about somebody who's favorable, or most likely they're going to tell you to talk to us, to a customer who's favorable. So you got to get someone who's hasn't been referred by the vendor, but who has had dealings with them or is using their product or something.
That makes sense.
But the next article here is, a ransomware law would require victims to disclose ransomware payments within 48 hours. And this comes from ZDNet.
I know you love those government regulations.
Oh, I know. These are my favorite. So this is a proposed bill called the Ransomware Disclosure Act, which is proposed by Senator Elizabeth Warren and Representative Deborah Ross. And it's really a bill forcing companies to simply disclose that they paid a ransom and the details around that ransom. And in the bill itself, there are 7 different pieces of information they want to get from this disclosure about what you paid or what was paid in the ransom. And this kind of comes off of what we talked about previously about, I can't remember which one it was. It was the Brookings Institute article about banning ransomware, but it's a data collection effort on behalf of the government to learn more about the ransomware market through the payment mechanism.
Yeah, that's really interesting to me that they're willing to pass a law to just for the notification part. That seems like a lot of work. Well, would it be publicly disclosed or would it just be privately disclosed to DHS?
Publicly disclosed. So they have to, the payee has to disclose to the government that they did this with these 7 points. And within the bill, it says that the government will have a public website, which is going to post this information minus the names of the companies.
Oh, interesting. I mean, I like more information, but I don't like new laws. This is always a twister.
Well, the thing is that within the bill, there's a, let's see if I can find it.
Hey, this bill's only 5 pages long.
Yeah, it's pretty short. No later than 1 year after the enactment of the act. And annually thereafter, they will publicly publish on a website of DHS the information disclosed.
You can tell this is not written by anybody related to security. Like, there's no information here on the compromise or anything like this. It's all on the date on which the ransom was demanded, which is probably pretty close to that. But like, nothing about the compromise itself. It's only on the ransom.
Well, if you go down to this, I don't know if people want to call it the second half so much, but further down there's a section that says study. Mm-hmm. And it says the secretary shall determine, shall conduct a study to determine if, and then there's 2 points here. One is, are there commonalities with respect to the information disclosed in the previous section? So
yeah.
What elements of those 7 questions are the same? And then B, the extent to which cryptocurrency has facilitated the kinds of attacks resulting in the payment of covered entities.
I feel like that's the main meat of what they're trying to do here.
Yeah, that's it right there. Is they want to use this to regulate or somehow, I guess regulate is probably the best term, the cryptocurrency market. And I think they're trying to use this as a bludgeon to do so. And I think that's quite plain in their, in what they say this study is supposed to do. Because basically the second one is not so much asking a question as demanding you show how this was true.
Yeah.
So it's going to be used as a bludgeon to say that cryptocurrency is heinous because it facilitates all sorts of bad ransomware stuff. And then they're going to come up with some method to impinge upon the way that current cryptocurrency is currently utilized.
Yeah, because they don't have any data points in here that there's only actually, you know what? Well, it kind of falls under seven. I was going to say they don't even include as one of these data points the Bitcoin address to which the ransom was paid, although I guess I could kind of go under seven for any known information regarding the identity of the actor.
Yeah, but it's vague enough that who knows what that's going to be put in. I mean, imagine if this is a freeform field on a DHS website. You're going to get all sorts of nonsense in here.
Is he like FIN7 and we think it's the Koreans or the Russians again or criminals? Yeah.
Yeah, Bob Jackson.
Yeah, like the, yeah, this is, I agree. I think this is definitely going after cryptocurrency because they're definitely not including any information that would help you identify the actors and try to figure out like, is, you know, is one actor doing the majority of it? Is it a bunch of small actors? Is it state-based actors versus criminal actors, et cetera, et cetera. There's no, with all this, this is all focused on the ransom and the crypto itself.
Right.
Which is, again, I would love to see a report of all the ransom that was done. I just don't know that I necessarily like that. That being said, despite the fact that this is a law, at least it is a simple law that is fairly narrow in scope. And this wasn't shoved into a giant omnibus bill of 4,000 pages. Right. I guess I'm going a little afield here.
Well, it's also proposed. It hasn't passed into law yet.
Yeah. That's right.
So we'll see where it goes with that.
Yeah. So if they pass this, are they going to remove two other laws?
maybe 2 years ago. But no, I mean, it's a law that was about regulation. But I suppose you have to do some kind of regulatory stuff to enforce the bill. So I don't know. I'm not sure how all that stuff works. It's a mess.
Yeah, I agree.
But I think, and I'm really surprised about the shortness of the bill, but I think it makes it quite plain what the objective of the bill is, even though they don't come out and say it.
Yep. No, it's interesting. I don't have much to say about it other than it won't actually help any of the security concerns, but, you know, it may help them decide to shut down crypto.
Well, I mean, this goes back to the conversation we've had before, that they're really going at this problem the wrong way.
Yeah. All right. Are you done with that article?
We are. We have time for the third one.
Oh yeah, we're only at 14 minutes.
Wow.
Yeah, this is gonna be good. All right, so article three, I picked up, actually this is an old article, but it popped up, Anton on Security, off of Medium. So this is an old article called Security Correlation Then and Now, The Sad Truth About SIEM. First half of the article is mostly kind of history about where SIEM came from and IDS and just sort of security operations and detections. And then he gets to, he's been talking with some of his friends and trying to figure out why the SIEM correlation searches are not working the way we think they should. And he came up with four hypotheses about why it's not working. And then a fifth, which is his own answer to it. But I kind of thought it was interesting to talk about each of these different reasons for security operations. Because I agree, I've been doing this for 10 years now, so not as long as him, but the way we built detection logic in ArcSight, you know, 8 years ago is pretty much the same way we build detection logic in Splunk now. Well, with some exceptions, and we may talk about those.
So you're saying Splunk is the modern ArcSight?
I think it is. I think it is getting that way. For all their talk about free text searching and how wild and free it was at the very beginning, you know, 7 years ago or 6 years ago when we first started working on it, like with the addition of Splunk ES and analytic stories and all the other stuff, it's getting pretty... Anyways, so the first, for his first reasoning was that products lack event normalization or do it poorly and rely on clients to go in and map the event names to a common information model or something like that. This one I was just discussing with David before we started the podcast. I yesterday was struggling on building a dashboard that took me 3-4 times as long because I was trying to correlate information between three different data sources that had different field names. I was doing a lot of coalescing to try and get stuff into a single field name so I could actually do a comparison between them. I was extremely frustrated.
That was from all security products?
I was from three different proxy products. I don't want to name and shame, but it was security products, and it was even in the same space.
We have the common information model.
Mm-hmm.
Why is this not being done at the security tool level, and we have to do this at the SIEM?
Yeah.
This is ridiculous.
Yeah. And frankly, it frequently is a low priority in the SIEM. There's so many other things these days. Even with Splunk, where, you know, Splunk was supposed to be better than ArcSight because ArcSight was so rigid. You had to bring stuff in and you had to map it to the common information model fields they were using. And that was one of the issues with it. Splunk was supposed to be better because you could just bring it in and you could just free text search and do whatever.
Well, I think part of the Splunk thing, though, was not necessarily that you could bring it in and do the free text search, which is, you know, you could obviously do. But Splunk was more aware and could try to assist you in doing that normalization. Whereas ArcSight was like, you have to do, you know, this goes to this, this goes to that. And Splunk, whereas when you do their normalization, they say, well, this looks like this and this looks like that. So it does some of the work for you there as mm-hmm. well.
Yeah. So that's definitely an ongoing problem, but let's move on to the other three rather than spend all that. We can come back. The second suggestion was that threat hunters won. The first suggestion was that the SOC analysts were just doing what they always did. Second suggestion is the threat hunters won, and they're trying to detect the same way that they hunt. And they're hunting by looking for stuff that they've seen before or stuff that's coming in from various threat intel feeds, you know, indicators, atomic indicators or specific techniques or specific executables used, things like that.
Yeah, it's like very granular pinpoint things. Like, yeah. I'm going to look for this one thing.
Which, in my opinion, isn't really hunting at all, but I've seen an awful lot of hunts that are done that way because I think that's easy for like C-levels to understand. Like, oh, we did a hunt for the indicators from this, you know, ransomware campaign and we're good. It's easy.
Yeah, I mean, it's better to have a hunt SOP that kind of outlines that versus individual hunters coming up with however they're going to do it. But I mean, that's not what our conversation's about. So
yeah, and that IOC stuff should be automated. You should have like a script or something that you just dump IOCs into a file and it goes out and it does the historical searching for you and then spits out detections. Like that should not be the focus of a manual hunt. But
right.
Yeah. But you're right. Hunting's not what we're talking about today. So the third one was tolerance for false positives is decreased. So writing narrower and narrower detections with lower false positive rates has become more popular, which I can actually see some of this. I know that when we were working together a couple of years ago, our false positive rate was ridiculous. It was extremely high, but we had a lot of people to kind of, you know, review those. And frankly, the leadership we had at the time was big on, we don't turn off alerts. We monitor everything. So that was a definite choice by leadership there. Whereas at an MSSP that I've worked with in recent times, they have a target for false positives. They don't want any more than 20% false positives. But of course, if you have a target like that, that definitely forces you, if you're over that target, you've got to start narrowing down some of your rules for sure.
Right. You have to have that cost benefit analysis of which you think is more risky.
Well, and this is one of those things we talked about. I know that this is not the way you're supposed to think about it. And I've actually had several disagreements with people, but I'm going to put it out there anyways. So publicly, if you disagree with me, please feel free to shoot me down. But I think the real limit is analyst time. If you've only got two analysts that are reviewing alerts, or if you've only got eight analysts that are reviewing alerts, or even 16, even if you're somewhere huge with a ton of analysts, analysts can only review so many alerts in a shift if you're doing the traditional SOC model. And sending them more alerts than that does you no good because they just will not get reviewed. And that's what happened to Target so many years ago, is the alerts caught the bad guys. And then the alerts were never reviewed.
Right. Yeah, you could kind of look at it and say, what's your SOC's alert throughput? Mm-hmm. And say, well, we can only operate at this level. because that's what our throughput is for the number of alerts that we get in. This is how many alerts can come in that we can process, that we can make decisions on.
Yeah. And you can do things like risk-based alerting, or you can do correlating between alerts, or you can do machine learning or UBA or something like that to try and reduce the number of alerts, but you still have kind of that hard top limit on how many alerts can be reviewed.
Right. Well, I mean, it can be a reviewed where you're actually going to get a reasonable answer, because it can be reviewed and say, oh, well, that's obviously a false positive, and then just move on. But actually looking at the problem and figuring out what truly happened and able to clearly put it into one bucket or another, that takes quite a bit of time. You need to understand that and ensure that your analysts are actually meeting that bar versus just, you know, moving to the side because they need to get through them.
Yeah. And the final one is that, The fourth one is that, basically there's just so much data being collected now, where it used to be, you know, you collected your IDS data, you collected your AV data, your firewall data, and that was it. That was all you were looking at. Now you're collecting your endpoint logs, you're collecting all of the 20 different sources that AWS produces, like your Lambda logs and your serverless stuff. You've got people are looking at database logs now, full packet capture. There's just so many data sources that it's almost impossible to normalize across all those data sources, which I think is a little bit bullshit. I mean, I'm not 100%, but again, if the impetus is on the vendor to map it to the SIEM, then it doesn't matter how many data sources you have to look at if the vendor is correctly, normalizing them. Then from your perspective, frankly, you can monitor any number of sources as long as they're all, you know, normalized correctly. Not necessarily, because when you have a completely different one, like a serverless or something like that, or a database versus a server, obviously those are very different data sources. But if they're normalized correctly, you can still do some of the same things with it. Like if database logins and server logins are both normalized for authentication events, you can run the same brute force detection logic against both without having to do additional work.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I'd say, yeah, and to some extent I agree, because there is like web servers have fundamentally different events than, you know, regular server logs versus serverless. So yeah, there's a little bit there. All right. And then finally, his final explanation is he thinks that it doesn't, the normalized and taxonomized approach in SIEM doesn't work now because it didn't work back in 2003, back in 2023, back in the day.
Back in my day.
Yeah. And he says it probably cannot work in today's world unless some things change in a big way. And I agree with that. I agree that the thing that needs to change in a big way is that vendors need to get their shit together and normalize stuff.
Yeah. I definitely agree, and I don't know why it's so hard for them to do this. If you go to the physical world, there are all sorts of standards that vendors have agreed to in, you know, computer hardware and other aspects of life that, you know, they didn't require a government law or regulation to do so either. And they just said, well, this makes the most sense for us to standardize on this format, this standard for things to be done. You know, like power outlets or USB, for instance.
You mean I don't have to replace all of my appliances when I move in a new house? I've been doing that for years.
Well, I thought your wife would have been doing that for years.
But she told me that we needed, you know.
And, you know, I was thinking about this. I wonder if it's possible for, you know, someone to actually sit down and maybe write like a C or a C++ library that does SIEM normalization or something, where you could put it on the net and vendors could just take it and then adopt it and put it into their stuff, where they wouldn't have to do the work to do all this. You kind of build it for them in this library, and all they have to do is adapt the library.
Someone still has to map it, though. I was really worried you were going to say standard. I was going to be like, we have five different competing standards. The only answer is to write another standard.
No. I mean, I mean, something like that happened not too long ago. I'm trying to remember what it was, where there were 10 standards, you know, and they talked about, well, we need to fix this. And a whole bunch of people got together and they came up with an 11th standard, which obviously fixed the other 10.
I'm going to,
that'd be great if there's some way you could come up with the 11th and then burn the other 10 to the ground. But
yeah, you have to force people. I'm going to stick that XKCD in the show notes, by the way. If you're not subscribed to XKCD, you absolutely should be.
But just something that makes the vendors, incentivize the vendors to do it. You know, if there's a low bar for them to take this library and implement it in the tool, then maybe we get some traction there.
I think we have to hold vendors accountable. I mean, I know that I think this is something that we should be doing for a number of things such as automation and standardization. If they don't support it, don't buy their tool. That should be part of your requirements when you look at a new tool. No API, no standardized logging. Goodbye.
Well, how many vendors though that produce security products today produce logs that are SIEM compliant out of the box?
I have no idea.
Because that sounds great if you can find somebody that does that. But if you're stuck in the boat where nobody does it, say, yeah. Oh, well, if you're not SIEM compliant with your logging, we're not going to take you. And then you just can't find any vendors. Then you're kind of stuck as well. I wish there was some way to convince vendors that that's a distinguishing factor for consideration that their logging be SIEM compliant. Actually, now that I think about it, I may start adding that to requirements for different vendors. Because when you talk to a vendor, typically, well, I'd say you should have, in my opinion, two different sets of requirements. You should have baseline technical requirements, and then you should have functional requirements, you know, ensuring that the tool does what it's supposed to be doing for whatever purpose it is. And then the baseline technical requirements are stuff like, you know, does it have a full API? Is it managed through a web interface? Does it use encrypted communications between the client and the server? You know, those kind of things with baseline technical requirements. So regardless of which tool you're looking at, you can apply these baseline technical requirements to any one of those things. And then you have the second piece that's the functional part of what it does. I think it might be a good idea to add a line in there about SIEM compliant logging or something, maybe. All right, our last article is ransomware risk assessment service aims to deflect attacks. And this comes to us from Security Week. And this is actually kind of a sales pitch for Qualys, which appears that they've come up with a concept for this service, which is
sponsor
basically...
Sponsor us! Sponsor us!
I'm not saying we're pitching Qualys' tool. I'm saying that Security Week is pitching Qualys' tool.
Fair enough.
I've had very little dealings with Qualys at all, to tell you the truth. So I'm not sure about the quality of their stuff. But what service they're offering is basically a scan and patch or a scan and configure automatic service for internet-facing solutions or applications or what have you. So Qualys has identified 110 CVEs used by most criminals in ransomware attacks. And what they're proposing is that they will basically scan your internet-facing systems looking for these 10 CVEs. If they find them, they will remediate them. And they will also look for configuration items such as poor RDP passwords and things of that nature and make automatic changes for that as well as part of this service in order to ensure that your edge is protected from the most likely avenues of attack for ransomware. And it just seems kind of odd to me because I was thinking, well, why do you need Qualys to do this?
That's what I was thinking. I was like, how is this different than a vulnerability scanner? It is. It's their vulnerability scanner just configured to look for a subset of things.
Right. With the patch component in there. Because I think this would be a fairly low bar to integrate whatever scanner you have with like a SUS server or something like that in order to implement patches. So I don't know how much money they spent on building this, but I don't see a lot of takers in this because if customers or, you know, companies or what have you would be are not that concerned about doing automated patching, you know, why would they not be doing automated patching? So I don't know. I wouldn't call this a service before its time, but I don't know. I think maybe they spent $10 on this and like, oh, well, it's, maybe we can get people to buy it. I don't know.
I mean, automated patching has got kind of the same issue as automated remediation with via SOAR tools. Like, nobody trusts it right now. And especially the way that people are doing patching with their 30-day cycles or 60-day cycles or whatever. I mean, I guess this does have some value in the sense that it is, since it's so narrowly focused, you might be able to get more buy-in for the automated patching. They're like, oh, we're not patching everything. We're just patching these, you know, whatever, some number of CVEs that are, some of them are from 2000 and flipping 12.
Right. And then, if you're a customer though, and you're only deploying 2019 servers, you know, how many of these CVEs are going to be relevant out of the gate? So it might be even a subset of that 112. I'd have to go back and, you know, have to see the list and what ones are affect your current server deployment list.
Yeah, but if you're deploying newly brand new stuff, you're probably not getting ransomware anyways.
Right. And hopefully your brand new stuff is already the default images up to date with its patching. Yeah.
The top five CVEs, there's two from 2013, one from 2012, one from 2018, and one from 2019. Ridiculous.
Right. Because you'd think you'd run this once, and if you weren't deploying new systems, you'd be done.
If you got CVEs from 2012, you deserve it.
Oh, come on now. No, I'm sure all sorts of organizations have all sorts of reasons that they're not up to date on that.
2012.
I would not say that you deserve it so much as that you have inherently accepted the risk by not implementing whatever controls need to be in place to ensure your patching is up to date.
You know, though, like, this vulnerability management is always such a redheaded stepchild of security programs, but really this is one of the most important things you can do. Like, the hygiene stuff like this and like proper configuration. I know it's not sexy. It's not hunting. It's not forensics. It's not incident response, but like, if you were serious about your security program, you would sink serious money into vulnerability management and configuration management.
Well, really the problem, and this is of course my own opinion on this, that it's not, it's the fact that you have so many stakeholders involved in it, you can't get the level of buy-in necessary to get it done correctly or well. Because really, I kind of see this as from a concept perspective, it's not a high bar in my opinion. Because here's kind of the way that I look at it, is you do a scan, you get your results. Those results are correlated with the patches for the most part. So you automatically patch in your dev instance. You have testing tools that test to make sure that those systems that were patched still work the way that they were expected to work after it's done. Once that's completed, it gets marked for approval to be pushed up to production, and then production is automatically patched. And if the test results fail, then there's a remediation thing figuring out why it failed and that part. But for the most part, there are instances where patching, especially Microsoft stuff, has gone awry in the last couple of years. But I would say more likely than not, the patches are not going to impact the functioning of a system. And if you have your automated tests in place to test in the dev environment before moving it to production, for most things, I think you'd be in pretty good shape. And you could automate this stuff and patch, have your patch cycle down to, you know, a week or less.
Yeah.
But you really have to get it to buy in, because if you work in IT, you understand that, sure, you are the one making sure the system's up and running and everything like that. But the business owner that relies on that application, whatever it is really the owner that dictates how that functions. And you have to get all these different business owners buy in to take these kinds of risks to do this kind of work. And I think that's really where the trouble's at. It's hard to get that buy-in, to get people to accept it. But I think when we do, then, you know, every vulnerability assessment provider out there is going to have a service like this.
Yeah, their vulnerability scanner they sell normally.
Yeah, with patching built into it.
Yeah, but I mean, or you can just do it by bringing an SCCM or something else.
Right. I mean, I'm saying it's not a high bar for even a regular company to do this all by themselves.
So wait a minute. It sounds to me like you're saying that rather than spending a bunch of money on a vulnerability management program, that money is better spent as bribes and blackmail for the other stakeholders to get them to patch their shit.
Whatever works.
Hookers and blow for all the product owners.
I mean, you have so much money to spend. Where are you going to spend it at? Fixing Vista or marketing? You just got to figure out where you're going to put that at.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that looks like all the articles we have for today. Thank you for joining us. Follow us at SerengetiSec on Twitter and subscribe on your favorite podcast app.